I want to welcome you to the Retro Rogues Live podcast. This is a segment from last week's live video show. The live show is available every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on Twitch, YouTube, and Twitter. Simply search for BassGod14, that's BASSGOD14, on either YouTube, Twitch, or Twitter. And now, on with the show. I want to welcome you to the Retro Rogues Live. Please pay attention to our warning graphic. It states that the Retro Rogues Live show is intended for an adult audience and not intended for children under the age of 13. Parental discretion is advised. Again, I want to welcome you to the show. My name is Dave Beatty, and I am one of your hosts on this Sunday afternoon show. So I'm fairly exact we're calling this one. But on this basically afternoon show, this matinee, if you will, we're going to be doing a Rogues retrospective. Or in my mind, what I would consider a John Carpenter classic, the movie They Live. We're going to be doing that, as well as a little bit of pop culture news a little bit later in the show, and that'll probably be it. So, and we'll just see how this goes. All right, I want to welcome back my co-host. This is Mr. Eric Alexander. Eric, please tell the folks, hopefully watching or listening at home, some of the fun things you have worked on as a creative professional.
Yes, hello everyone. I'm Eric Alexander, also known as BassGod14. That's BassGod14, not BassGod. That's BassGod, like a bass guitar. And I am the chief financial officer of a small production company located in Arizona called Bad Bob Productions. And currently I'm an executive producer on a project called Staycation, which is actually supposed to be gearing up again this month for some additional filming.
Very cool. Very cool. And I always love the Sunday afternoon show for some reason with the intro, because I'm always trying to remember to plug what we're talking about. And I always goof it up. But I'm a professional illustrator and graphic designer. For the last 30 years, I worked on a lot of fun things that some people sort of heard of, such as we'll go with X-Men, sort of the Braddocks. We'll go with Grifter, because I'm going to talk about Grifter a little bit today, and also Justice League of America. I do have another fun, amazing announcement to make, but we're probably going to do that on the Thursday show. So if you're curious to hear about what new project I'm going to be working on, you're going to have to probably wait until Thursday when we can actually plan it a little bit better. All right. So enough about that. Let's go ahead and get into this Rogues retrospective. Now, for a Rogues retrospective, the way this basically works is we want to start off by talking about how did we first hear about the film? Okay, so that's how we're going to start. Then after that, we're going to talk about kind of how we felt about the film when we originally saw it. And then we're going to talk about the film in basic current context, having recently revisited the film or recently rewatched the film. How do we feel about the film today? So those are our components. How did we first hear about it? How did we feel about it then? How do we feel about it today? All right, so we are going to be talking about the John Carpenter film from 1988, They Live. Now, I'm going to read the summary here that comes off of IMDb just real quick, and I'm going to throw it over to Eric for let him to go ahead and get us started actually talking about how he first heard about the film. So the summary that comes from IMDb reads as such. They influence our decisions without us knowing it. They numb our senses without us feeling it. They control our lives without us realizing it. They live. All right, so that's coming from IMDb. So tell me, Eric, how did you first hear about the film, They Live?
Well, first of all, I just want to acknowledge the Rose Gallery. There, Jane is in the house. She says, hey, guys, it's good to see you, Jane. We appreciate you coming out tonight, or today, Hi, I should Mom. Say, this afternoon. I have to get used to that format because we haven't been doing the afternoon format for very long. Most of our shows have always been in the evening. And we still do an evening show every Thursday. That's our Collector's Corner focus show. So They Live is kind of interesting for me because when it first came out, I was basically too young to see it. I wasn't really supposed to be watching rated R movies at that time. Not sure if I've even seen a rated R. Well, I'm sure I had, at least at a friend's house. I'd seen a rated R movie at that time. But when it first came out, I wasn't really aware of it. It was, like I said, it's a rated R movie. I was quite young, fairly strict, household. So initially I heard about it from my older brother. My older brother was in college at the time. He's quite a bit older than I am. And he was in college, and I seem to remember him coming back on a visit and sort of obsessing about this movie. He used to like to do that. He used to like to tell me about things that he had seen, whether or books that he had read or something like that. He used to like to tell his little brother stories. And that's the context that I first remember hearing about They Live. And so I kind of knew what the story was before I ever saw it. And then I can't remember if we actually rented it or if it simply came on TV one day, you know, on a cable channel or something like that, because, you know, a little bit older, that's when we first got cable. I was like one of the last people to get cable also on my block. But I remember, I feel like I saw it on television, and I feel like I don't feel like we rented it. It's kind of a vague feeling. I know I've seen it multiple times on cable, and it's one of those movies that I know, generally speaking, it would be on and I would just watch it. It wasn't like appointment television where I knew it was going to be on and I specifically was waiting for it with my popcorn and all that stuff and ready to go. And it's funny because I realized there's a lot of the movie, especially the first act, I don't remember because it's been a while since I've actually watched this. And so I believe what happened was it came on cable at one point and I finally got to see it. Basically, it was one of those deals maybe where my brother was like, hey, it's on, you know, that kind of a thing. That movie I told you about, you know, let's watch it. I was very familiar with Rowdy Piper. At the time, he was, you know, I was big into professional wrestling, especially the WWF. And I was, you know, even though I mentioned a previous episode, I hadn't really seen Roddy Piper like wrestle that much, because WrestleMania 1 and 2 happened when I was like, again, I was like too young. I did see those later on VHS. My dad actually did rent those, so I did get to see those later. But like at his peak of his wrestling, I really didn't see him much. I used to know him from his commentating, because he used to be one of the commentators for the matches a lot. And then he also did the Piper's Pit. So that's what I really kind of knew Roddy Piper from. And then I've mentioned previously, I actually did get a chance to meet him later on. And I can't say enough good things about Roddy Piper and about meeting him. But yeah, it's kind of a vague thing, you know, because I remember my brother talking about it. I know I saw it at some point later on. I believe it was basically on cable, and it was probably one of those deals, like I said, with my brother's like, hey, it's on, let's check it out. And wherever it started, that's where I saw it from. So that's basically how I heard about it.
All right, very cool. Now, the way that I had first heard about They Live I had had friends who, when I was in high school, they wanted to be filmmakers. And they were two really good friends of mine. And if memory serves, because I did not see this in the theater either, there was a lot of discussion about John Carpenter's work, because John Carpenter was known for making, you know, films that did relatively well at the box office and were highly touted and discussed, but he also made them for a kind of a more modest budget. We'll put it that way. Okay. And that's what he was known for, is being able, at least among my circle of friends, whether the Hollywood considers this or not, I'm not talking about Hollywood. I'm talking about within my circle of friends, the way that John Carpenter was discussed. John Carpenter's discussed for being able to work magic with, you know, a modest budget. And my two friends who wanted to be filmmakers were very interested in his work and were constantly talking about it. But it's weird because the four of us didn't actually sit down and watch this film together until I think all of us were kind of freshman year in college. And for some reason, someone finally decided to rent this movie. And I'd seen a lot of the other John Carpenter films that they talked about, you know, like The Fog. I think it was Precinct 77. Maybe I got that wrong. I'm a John Carpenter fan, but I'm not an expert. Okay, so bear with me. I might misspeak a little bit here and there, but I don't mean to. But anyhow, the decision was we're going to do a John Carpenter marathon. So they had rented a whole bunch of John Carpenter's movies that included Halloween. And They Live was one of the films that we had rented. And I was like, oh, awesome, because I'd never actually seen it. And it was weird because they talked about this film, but I still in my mind's eye didn't quite understand exactly what the film was about. And that was the first time that I had actually watched it, was actually with them. We rented it on VHS. So it was the, you know, the theatrical version of the film. It didn't have anything cut out. It wasn't edited for television or anything like that. Not that this film has a bunch of stuff that have to be edited until you get to the very end, I think. But that was how, that was the first time I'd actually seen the film, was actually on VHS with them. But it was after I'd already heard a lot about this movie. And it's so weird because there's this weird horror movie that involves like a baby with fangs. Like, I don't remember what, I think it was Alive was the name of that movie. I don't know. Anyhow, for some reason, in my mind, incorrectly, I always associated that weird demon baby with the fangs that was supposedly eating people with They Live. I don't know why that was, but for the longest time when they would talk about this movie, I was like going, well, where does the baby that eats people come in? Like, I don't understand people. How do they feed the people to the baby? Like, what is, so I don't understand why it was, but I just remember being horribly disturbed as a kid by seeing that image in a Starlog magazine. And for some reason in my mind, I attached it with this title, They Live, because you would think that goes together, right? Weird demon baby with fangs eating people, They Live. You know, I don't know. I don't know where I got that idea. So, yeah, you know, when I watched the film, I was kind of surprised to see what the film was actually really kind of about. And then I was like, oh, this is actually, I remember back in the day, I thought it was a very good film and I really enjoyed it. And it's, it was kind of became a favorite of mine. And then I remember a few years later, I actually bought it actually on like previewed on VHS tape. And I had it on a VHS tape for like the longest time. And periodically I would put it in. Periodically I would loan it to people who'd never actually seen the film. It's like, oh, you got to see this movie. It's awesome. And it used to sit on the same shelf as, in my mind anyway, the other John Carpenter classics, such as Halloween, and also Escape from New York. Now, I will tell you right now, while Halloween is a seminal horror movie, my favorite John Carpenter movie is still Escape from New York. But I have quite a fondness for They Live as well. So that was how I first heard about it. It was just being discussed amongst my friends because in the circle that I traveled in, there seemed to be this belief that John Carpenter could work magic with a modest budget. So they were constantly talking about his films. And that was the pretext and the context from which I first heard about this film, They Live. Now, those of you that are watching the show, we want to know the same thing from you. We want to know what you think. We want to hear how you first heard about They Live. So wherever you are, whether you're on Twitch or Facebook, it doesn't matter, Twitter, please post into the comments section where you first heard about They Live, because we want to discuss this with you. We care very much about your opinions and your thoughts. That's intended to be an open discussion amongst all of us about the film. So with that being said, let's go ahead and segue into the initial part. When you first saw this film, Eric, what did you think about the film, They Live?
So again, I definitely went in with an expectation, and I'm trying to think if like, was my expectation maybe, you know, bigger than what it actually ended up being. And I don't have that feeling, you know. So obviously, you know, my older brother had told me about it, and he had told me pretty much, you know, the whole story. So it wasn't like it was really shocking to me about what was happening in the movie. There wasn't like some big surprise. But I don't remember being like underwhelmed or anything like that, because, you know, as a kid, you'll develop things in your mind. And a lot of times that kind of will ruin a film when somebody talks to you. You know, everybody's big on spoilers these days, right? Please, no spoilers, right? Well, I was already spoiled, and I still remember really enjoying the film. Again, I was a fan of Roddy Piper. That does help quite a bit when you're a wrestling fan. And, you know, he didn't do a lot of movies, quite frankly. So it's kind of nice to see him. And in a way, it's kind of bittersweet, too, because, you know, you realize that, you know, he could have probably done so much more than he actually did. But because I think he did a fantastic job in the movie. So there was that sort of novelty of the fact that Roddy Piper is the main star in this film. But I just remember really, really enjoying it. There's a lot of action in this movie. So, you know, if you're into that, it's definitely something. You know, again, it kind of makes me think like, you know, Roddy Piper could have been in the same league as like Stallone and Schwarzenegger and folks like that. He really could have. And if he had been given more of a chance, because you see that he has the chops in this film. So I remember thinking that was really cool. That was really neat. And of course, the fight. I think everybody, you know, who's seen this movie, you have to talk about the fight in the alleyway between Roddy Piper and the other main character, his buddy. Epic fight. It's like 5 minutes long. I mean, in some ways, it almost feels like it's too long. I remember thinking that, when I first saw it, and I definitely still think that to this day. And one of the things that's funny is back in the day, I remember constantly thinking, you know, why doesn't he just put the glasses on? Why doesn't he just put the glasses on? And it's kind of funny because my perspective has changed since then. So when we talk about how we feel about it today, my perspective definitely has changed since I've gotten older. But I do remember that epic fight scene, and I remember just thinking constantly, why doesn't he just put the damn sunglasses on? So that was my impression back when I first saw it.
All right. Well, very cool. I remember when I originally saw this film, that I was kind of surprised at how interesting it was. And I was also oddly surprised when I first saw it that it was as science fiction as it is. Now, what I mean by that is, when you start watching the film, it's kind of shot in, you know, real locales. Matter of fact, I watched some of the making of documentary, and they talked about actually when they actually visit the actual homeless area where all the homeless people are living, that they actually shot that at an actual real place, and they paid all those people as basically extras for the day when they were shooting there. And I remembered it being very grounded and very kind of realistic, right? But at the same point, too, kind of guerrilla filmmaking, right? And again, you have to remember, my friends talked about John Carpenter context of that he can work magic with a modest budget, okay? So I wasn't expecting any of the things that happen later in the film, where it does get as kind of science fiction-y as it does. I wasn't expecting to see some of the things that they show us later on. Now, they're not crazy, super expensive effect shots, the way that they're set up or anything. But I just remember it even back then being surprised at that, because it feels like we're not going to see those things, right? Like, you know, you're not going to see how, and again, we're assuming that you've seen this film, how you would actually, I didn't expect to see some of that stuff, even revisiting the film here recently. Like, I was still kind of, I'm surprised how, as many times as I've seen this movie, I'm still surprised that we actually see some of the stuff that we see in this film. Because in my mind anyway, it feels like it's being shot on, at times, such a tight budget that they wouldn't even attempt to do some of the stuff that they actually, you know, actually show us in the film. It sounds kind of silly to put it in that way, but
no, it doesn't actually. It makes me think like it would be interesting, you know, if they had shot it in a way where you couldn't actually see what he sees in the glasses. Like if he had to describe it somehow or something like that. And I could see that as being a trick to definitely bring the budget down, which according to Wikipedia, this film had a $3 million budget. So definitely very modest for the time. And also for a film that they were, you know, shooting on location. Like you said, it does feel like they were shooting very guerrilla, but there's a lot of high production elements in this film. You know, there's lots of, police chases and things like that with police cars, helicopters, all sorts of stuff that you're like, how did they fit that all on that budget? But it does make me think what you just said. It would have been interesting to have a take like that where you couldn't see what he's seen through the glasses, which, you know, we have the poster up right now, and right there, you the reveal's right there on the poster as far as what he's actually seeing. But I actually think that's kind of interesting, Dave, because I think it would make the film a lot different if they did that. And of course it would have saved them some money on an already tight budget.
Yeah. It's interesting. And I just remembered just the first time I saw it, like being impressed. You know, it's like a lot of Carpenter's early work. You know, when you look at, when you go and you watch Halloween, like Halloween works incredibly well, right? It's a really good horror movie. You know, it kind of birthed, in my mind anyway, what we think of as the, at least back then, the slasher genre. And it's such a great use of music and direction. And it's and just it's just amazing to see what he was able to do with that, when, especially when you start thinking through, like, well, how expensive was this movie? You know what I mean? Because it's like, it's I don't know. It's just really interesting to revisit. And then you go and you look at something like Escape from New York, which seems to be, in my mind anyway, the most, you know, sort of budget intensive, ambitious, at least in my mind, of the John Carpenter films, you know. But it's interesting when you look at John Carpenter's early films, how different they are from each other and how well they work. They all work incredibly well. And that's the thing. And I remember that time too, because it seemed like it reminded me of, and this is going to be, this is going to be potentially offensive to some people, but don't take this the wrong way. It reminded me of M. Night Shyamalan in the sense that, and I don't mean the sense as a pun either, but it reminded me in the sense that when you see a lot of M. Night's early films, they're so well put together and they work so incredibly well and they're really good films, you know, until, depending upon your mileage, you get either to The Village or The Happening and it kind of goes off the rails. But it's kind of like that. It's like some of these films are so well constructed and they're so good. I just remember being really impressed with it when I first saw it. I was like, wow, this guy did an amazing job with this. I mean, it's limited makeup effect shots, right? There's limited special effects shots. You know, he got some great performances out of his actors, you know? I mean, Keith David is a great character actor, but yeah. I can't think of too many times where he's actually, you know, the co-star, you know what I mean? And in such an important lead role in a film, you know, but he's such a great, great actor, you know? You don't get to see that much of him, in my opinion. And it's really neat because
he's got an awesome voice, yeah.
And he's very front and center in this film, you know, and an important and integral part of it. So I just remember being impressed with the film when I originally saw it.
Yeah, I think in the context, it is very impressive. Jane had a comment that I think is interesting perspective here. Jane says, I have not seen this movie, but a TV series from 1967 to 68 sounds like this show Invasion. One guy was the only one with glasses who could see the aliens. And that's an interesting that you call that out, Jane, because I've never heard anybody actually compare this show or compare this movie to that show. But I can see it now that you've said it. Now that you've said it, I can totally, totally see that comparison, which is very interesting because, again, I haven't ever read anything. And in my research, nobody kind of called that out, you know, but it's there. It's definitely there. It is very similar.
And it's important to remember this is based off of a story, a short story. And then the difference is, spoiler alert, the big difference is that it has a similar context, but the elements that Carpenter introduces is the control aspect. It's a little bit more pervasive in the influence. We can't really get too much further into this till we get to the spoiler part of this.
Have you read the short story or the comic book version of the short story?
I have read the comic book version of the short story, so cool. I am familiar with it. And here's the thing that's interesting about They Live, and I was trying to remember because this came out in 88. Do you remember when the series came out?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah.
It seems like. Because it's interesting because in the original story that They Live is adapted from or attempts to adapt, however you want to look at it. In the original story, the aliens are lizards. They look like lizard people. And I couldn't help but think, because I've never actually looked at They Live from an analytical standpoint. Like, this is the first time I've really watched the film and kind of like tried to see it from a bunch of different angles, you know, for the show today. Normally I just watch it and just like it, you know what I mean?
Right.
An important part of this film is Roddy Piper's performance. I mean, let's be honest, that's the big selling point in my mind anyway, with this, between him and Keith David. I mean, they make this movie.
Yes.
And I kept thinking of, which is weird. As I was reflecting on the comic book version of the story, and then also thinking of, the television series, the miniseries, the first one. The main reason is because of Meg Foster. Meg Foster is the female lead, one of the main characters in this. She runs the, or is one of the executives of the television network or whatever. And it's really interesting because I kept thinking of that because she looks so otherworldly. And I kept thinking of, what is it, Jane Balder or whatever from V? Like, and at times rewatching this, which I guess we should segue into the rewatching this portion, it kept throwing me off because I kept thinking of how these themes have been done so many different ways. And to take it even further, with a slightly different context made in a slightly different time, you could have had Van Damme, you know, Chance Boudreau, you know, from Hard Target, you know, there's, you know, and I was also thinking of the way Stallone from Rambo, you know, he's just wandering, you know, and he just wanders into that town. And I kept thinking about how all these different elements have been, how they're always revisited in different ways. I'm not saying that they live influence Rambo. I'm just saying how there's a commonality of theme. And because one of the interesting things about this film is the fact that Rowdy Piper's character's name is Nada.
Right.
Yeah, and when you watch some of the let's go ahead and segue because I'm already getting into there. So we're going to start talking about how we feel about the film today, having revisited it, because I'm getting way too knee deep into the details at this point. So we're going to kind of start doing some spoilery portions here. Because in order to discuss this film in the context that I think it'd be interesting to talk about it, we got to get into kind of some spoilers. So let's start off with just an overview. Eric, how did you feel about rewatching the film today?
I enjoyed watching it. What I realized was how much I am unfamiliar with the first act. That goes back to when I was talking about when I first watched it. I feel like I did definitely watch it on cable and we didn't rent it or something like that. Like I just saw it wherever it came in and I basically only seen it where it comes in ever since. I don't own this film. I didn't even realize that it was on a streaming service until we decided to do this review. And then I found it was on Peacock. So for those of you that want to watch the film and want to watch it this afternoon, it's on Peacock and it's on the free side of Peacock, which is nice. You don't have to pay for it. I'm very, very unfamiliar with the first act. It actually felt like I was watching it for the first time. And I really question whether I've ever seen the first act before. It was that different to me. And it does really kind of change a lot of the tone of the movie for me, because I have seen the other parts of it multiple times. I've seen that fight probably a dozen times. And then I've always, you know, watched it onward from there. So it does kind of change the tone of the film. It does, I think, as you mentioned, it does kind of give it an interesting grounding because it does kind of feel, at least the beginning, that first act, it does definitely feel more like the real world, if you will. Like you can kind of relate to that. It's kind of like that. Every man, you know, like that basically is having a tough time. He's trying to make his way. And then he realizes that there's something far bigger than him that's keeping him from accomplishing his goals, just keeping him from being basically a happy person. The movie that actually stuck out to me watching it today or watching it last night was actually The Matrix. And it's kind of like this idea of your worldview is totally wrong. You know, it's basically, that's the idea. That's the theme that I actually really got from this. And I really felt The Matrix, you know, again, because the first act was made a big impression on me because I don't remember it. I don't remember the first act at all prior to watching this last night. And it really kind of felt to me like it had that theme of this sort of awakening where a character is basically, you know, kind of just, you know, plodding along, not really doing anything spectacular with their life. Their life kind of sucks, actually. They're kind of just a cog in the machine, for a lack of a better term. And suddenly they're awakened to realize that this machine is not what they thought it was. It's completely different. The entire world works completely differently than this character thinks it did. So the first act made a very big impression on me, as far as the tone of the movie and then the themes that I was picking up on. And then also, as I mentioned, the fight scene is kind of worked for me because I sort of realized the perspective of the supporting character's name is Frank, of Frank's perspective, basically when Nada, is basically coming to him about, you know, check out these glasses. Well, at this point, Frank already knows that this guy supposedly has gone into a bank and shot all these innocent people and basically is a fugitive. You kind of wonder, like, why is he even going over to give the guy some money or helping him out in any way? Because from his perspective, this guy has to be a complete and total psycho, like, you know, like the Columbine killers or something like that, right? It's just like, why would he have anything to do with this guy? So I thought that was interesting also because my perspective changed there, whereas, you know, as I said, when I was younger, I was always all like, why does he just put the glasses? Now I'm just like, why is he even there? Why is he even talking to this guy? This guy is a psycho. He should have called the police immediately when he saw him, you know? And he actually even tries to give him money at first and stuff. It's like, why would you be doing that? And I always kind of assume for some reason, again, because I think I missed the first act so often, I thought they were like good buddies from, like, you know, back in the day or something like that. And it's like, no, they just met each other at the beginning of the film, you know, so they don't even really know each other. They really don't have it. So my perspective changed on all that stuff as well, you know, watching it. And it just made it kind of funny to me. It was just like, this doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but it's like, you know, when you're younger, you really don't see those kind of things. So that was interesting to me. Now, John McClay's in the house and he says that he loves this movie. And of course, he quotes the very, very famous line, I came here to chew gum and kick ass. And of course, I'm all out of gum, John. I'm all out of gum. And then John mentions the fight scene. Most realistic fist fight in film. Laugh out loud. And I do think even if you don't like this film, you watch it for that fight alone. It's just one of those epic cinematic fights. And it's one of those things. It's just like you have to see it to believe it because it almost goes too long, but it ends up being kind of perfect the way it is. But it is a crazy, crazy fight scene, and people talk about it all the time in the context of this movie. In fact, I think there's probably people that have only seen the fight scene and pretty much discard the rest of the movie. You know what I mean? But so. Definitely, definitely. And then Jane had a comment. She said, I watched V. Says I was pregnant with Ronnie. When the episode where a human woman was giving birth to an alien baby, when the lizard looking baby came crawling out, I got up, turned the TV off. It really freaked me out. And Jane, I remember that moment. That was a big moment in television history when they had the birth of the V alien. I still remember that, the twins actually. I own all three of the V incarnations, the miniseries, the follow-up, the final battle, and then also the series, the short-lived series. That's one that I think would be fun to talk about on a future Rogues retrospective for sure.
Here's the thing. I told Eric, I said, normally I don't watch the film this close to the show. But I did actually watch it today, actually before the broadcast. And then I did go out and I watched a bunch of making of documentaries in order to kind of put it in a proper context in my mind. And the concept, the idea I'm thinking about is how the idea of the everyman, you know, you bring up the Matrix, Eric. And the reason that Roddy Piper's character, which is interesting, because I think the Funko Pop character actually has like a full name, but the actual character in the movie is just called Nada. And if you watch the behind the scenes stuff about it, the reason they called him Nada is because they didn't really even want to necessarily give the character name, to the point that John Carpenter said that he wanted Roddy Piper to know who his character was and to have a whole backstory in the back of his head, but that he didn't want to know what that backstory was because he just wanted him to be the everyman, right? That he could be anyone and he could be everyone. And it's interesting because as the film unfolds, it's obvious that he has a certain set of skills, right? Like he's able to definitely handle himself, right, to an extent. But I kept thinking about this concept because you know, if you remake this movie at a different time, you know, it's interesting how the everyman concept for a snapshot, a period in time, how the everyman was typified by a certain kind of concept. And I thought that was interesting. And I talked about how, or at least I think anyway, it's interesting to me, you know, Rambo kind of starts in kind of a similar fashion, right? Guy comes wandering into town. He's got everything he owns on his back. They live. Guy comes wandering into town, has everything he owns on his back. You know, I thought there's a weird parallel here with The Hunted. Hard Target, I'm sorry. You know, I meant Hard Target, the Van Damme movie. It's just an interesting idea that I feel like it's a little bit, I didn't realize how prevalent it was until I watched this film. And I was like, you know what? This concept has been used quite a bit. You know, as far as the fight scene goes, I enjoyed it. You know, like I said, I do enjoy this film quite a bit. It has been a little while since I've seen it, though, because I actually sold all my VHS tapes in a yard sale many moons ago. And it's been a little while since I've seen this film. And for those of you who are interested, curious to watch They Live, it is available. You can watch it basically streaming, essentially on demand, right? Basically, you just turn it on and you can actually watch it on the Peacock Network. So if you're interested to watch it, you haven't seen it, or you haven't seen it in a little while, you want to revisit it, it is on Peacock. So you just watch it through the app. I streamed it to the television. It played really well. It's a good transfer. It's got good sound. Now,
yeah, I'll say that it's actually better than the Disney app. I have problems with the Disney app to this day, where it will buffer. I didn't have any buffering problems watching this on the Peacock, so I'm going to give Universal that.
And I will say this, the film shows its age in a few different places. Some of the effect shots look a little dated. Some of the makeup effects work better than others. So there's some of the shots where the makeup effects work so incredibly well that it's almost seamless. And then there's other shots where the makeup effects don't work very good at all. And it's kind of hit or miss. And I don't think I've ever looked at it with quite this like critical of an eye before. And that's kind of the one thing. So if you haven't seen the film before and you're coming to it new, I feel like that's where the film's going to show its age more than the time period. You know, it's just in the fact that some of the effect shots, while they're still practical and some of them look incredibly well, some of them you could tell that maybe the budget wasn't there to rework a shot, you know what I mean, and just reshoot it. You know, they just decided just to leave some of these shots, and I think that might have had something to do with budget. But I feel like the film is still pretty good. Now, from a... it's interesting because you watch interviews about Carpenter. He talks about the fact that he wanted this as a commentary on Reagan's America. And that's interesting because I feel like depending upon your political slant, depending upon when you watch this film, this could be a commentary on anybody's America at any given time. If you feel like that a particular group of people are keeping you down, like it's such a broad context in which this film approaches this idea that while he intended it to be for Reagan's America, I could see where anybody could apply this to any particular party that's in power. So I don't know. I understand what he was going for and I can kind of see it, but at the same point, it wouldn't take much to see it from a slightly different point of view. Wouldn't you agree, Eric? I mean, it just, to me, it just, you know, there's an interesting concept where they talk about, he says in a later interview, he talks about how he says, well, maybe in hindsight, it should be a commentary on the difference between good governance and bad governance.
I honestly don't really see that. I understand the perspective. I understand what he was going for. But to me, if you even go farther back, you know, one of the influences clearly is, you know, like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, right? And they always say Invasion of the Body Snatchers was an allegory for the Red Menace and for communism, right? And so what I see here is a very much, it actually is very applicable to the times we live in right now, where people are concerned about subversive elements. And people are concerned about that on both sides of the aisle. You know what I mean? Whether you're talking about, you know, I've actually heard people talk about comparing this to some ideas of white supremacy, which, you know, John Carpenter has flatly denied, basically saying, no, it's not that. And then, of course, on you know the other side, you have things like the continuing, you know, role of international communism and things like that. Things that I would call maybe like neo-Marxism. Concerns like that, basically, of being infiltrated. That's the bottom line. It's basically like your shadow government. You know, I'll say it. It's just like, you know, basically the deep state. I mean, that's what we're really talking about here. That's really what this is, right? So, because there's what you're seeing on the surface, and there's what's really, you know, who's pulling the strings, you know, the puppeteers, if you will. So I think that's a pretty universal concept. I think, you see it on both sides, you know, both sides where people like will say that or feel that or whatever. So it's definitely very universal. But like I said, if you want to go back to something that's very much like this and probably, I mean, definitely influenced it, it's Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And that was, you know, they always say that was about the Red Menace. So I think you can take it, you can definitely take it different ways, but I definitely see it as that idea of that sort of subversive hidden element of society that is controlling things that you really just, you don't understand, that you don't know.
Yeah, and that's what I was talking about. It's framed in such a context. It's such a wide net, you know, that depending upon your point of view, you could imprint upon, you know, the aliens and the threat and what they're doing. You could almost imprint that upon anyone, you know, regardless right. of which political affiliation. So I thought that was interesting because, you know, watching the interviews, I had never really thought of it as a commentary on Reagan's America. And so when I was rewatching it because I'd seen all those documentaries, like, why? I still don't see that. I see this as any, you know, I think subversive is the best way to look at it, Eric, the term that you use. Any subversive element that's looking to control and influence a group of people. And it's weirdly as applicable today as it was when he made the film back in the 80s, but from a slightly different point of view. So it's just interesting to me how relevant the film is. I think because it isn't so pigeonholed and it does cast a wide net, you know, that it is in that way still able to be relevant in a modern context, and not necessarily easily dismissed, you know, because it's too of the time. So it's just interesting. All right. So I'm going to come down on the side that if you've never seen They Live, again, you can watch it for free on the Peacock, on the Peacock app. I would recommend people take a look at it if you've never seen it. If you haven't revisited it, you're looking for something to watch this afternoon. That's what this show's all about. Have a fun conversation about a film that's available out there that when we get done, you know, you can go over there and check it out. So I feel like They Live is definitely worth a rewatch or actually watching for the first time. How do you feel about it, Eric?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that you'll definitely get something out of it. I don't feel it's really dated at all. I feel that it's a very contemporary film. I think it's going to be one of those films that, you know, you can watch for decades to come, because there's all sorts of stuff you can get out of it, even with, you know, things that are going on today. And so I think it's one of those films that in a lot of ways is timeless and ageless. And it does have actually, in my mind, an exceptional production value, especially for the money.
All right. Very cool. I am, because I talked about it, I have pulled a couple of things up here I want to talk about here just briefly. I'm going to share my screen here. Well, let me click that the opposite direction. I just de-shared the screen. If de-share is such a thing. All right. So I talked about one of the things that I enjoyed about working on the DC Comics New 52 series, Grifter, was the idea that when we were originally being pitched the series, Scott Clark and myself, it was kind of being described as sort of like a DC Comics superhero version of They Live. And while I feel like at times that it lived up to that concept and other times it failed at that concept, I do personally think it's very interesting having rewatched, because it's weird, because I remember rewatching it before we started work on Grifter. I always take stuff too far. So before we started work on Grifter, I reached out to a friend of mine who was a firearms aficionado. And I went out and actually spent a day shooting, Eric. That's how far I took this, because I knew we were going to be using a lot of guns in Grifter, and the majority of what I'd done was I had, you know, shot a lot of shotguns and a lot of rifles in the scouts. I used to do, they used to have the senior patrol leader and the scout master shoot off at Campery and occasionally at summer camp. So you would go out to the range and, you know, you would shoot the clay targets and whatever. And I used to compete in that capacity kind of off and on when I was in the Boy Scouts. But I'd not shot a lot of more contemporary weapons. You know, I'd never served in the military. The majority of time that I'd spent with more contemporary handguns, for that matter, was actually doing disarms when I was doing martial arts. And so I wanted to become a little bit more familiar so that when I was drawing and putting the book together, because an inker's job is at the end of the day is to make sure that stuff matches up and works. So if the penciler has drawn something where the character's off model and something doesn't look right, or there's something that doesn't quite work, then the inker's job is actually to go in and make it more clear. That's actually one of the directives that an inker is actually given, at least at the time in which I worked at DC Comics. You're not tracing what's there. You're supposed to be making an artistic contribution and you're supposed to be adding to the narrative, okay? So I went out and spent some time on the range, learning to use a lot of different firearms I'd never touched before in my life, learning how they actually worked. I did rewatch They Live at that time. And it was weird to me because I had forgotten how much our first issue of Grifter, number 4, that's the first issue that Scott and I came on board the series, how much it paralleled They Live to the extent that at the time, I don't think I really completely understood it. So what I've got open here, this is actually the big splash page from issue 4. This is labeled 3C, if you can see, because these are my original files. But as we can see right here, this is Grifter. He's crashed a car into a building. This is actually Q-Corps, which is actually Oliver Queen, one of his companies. But if you can see right here, this person, he's got this gun taped to their head. This is one of the Daemonite aliens. And here's the thing that made this book so interesting. So the general gist of this series is that they were trying to do an experiment. These aliens are in control, just like the Obey aliens from They Live. It's the same idea, okay, but not everyone can see them. They were trying to do an experiment on him, and they actually, there was an accident, and then afterwards, he can see the aliens, but no one else can see the aliens. And at that time, he starts basically working against them because he has a background in basically counterterrorism, and he was like ex-Special Forces. And so he goes on these operations trying to take out these different kind of strongholds and different things and to call attention to the aliens that are in our midst. And he kind of assumes essentially this supervillain identity. It's why he's wearing a mask, okay? But he's wanted as a terrorist. That's kind of the thing that's interesting, especially when you consider the period in which this book was actually produced. But I was looking at pages, thinking about which ones to talk about. And I thought, how odd it is that this kind of reminds me of the scene in the bank. And at the time, I don't think I really saw it, you know, because, you know, Nada just comes walking into the bank with a shotgun, right? Yeah. the classic scene, right? And I'd never realized it before how when Scott set this scene up, how it was very clear that's what he was thinking of. And I totally missed that at the time. But we've got a sequence here from this particular sequence, but again, it's kind of this idea. He can see the aliens, but no one else can, and he's basically trying to get essentially a response. He's trying to get the police to notice. He's trying to get the superheroes to notice. He's trying to get someone else to see the invasion that's happening in front of everyone's eyes that only he can see. And then the big moment in this is the person who actually sees what he's doing and actually responds is actually Green Arrow. So this kind of a fun sequence here. And I was thinking about how having these two fight, while not the same thing, as, you know, what happens between, you know, Keith David's character and Rowdy Piper's character, how it also echoed that at the same time as well, which I found oddly curious in hindsight. So my goal is not get you to go out and run down a copy of the first trade paperback of Grifter. But my thought is, I was surprised revisiting this work that I had. Again, I'd worked on this, but I knew that's what we were doing. But at the same point, I don't think it really sunk in as much. Having just watched They Lived and then actually revisiting this work from the Grifter series, I was like, wow, we really were kind of right on the money with what we were trying to do. So I thought that was really kind of interesting.
That's really cool. That's neat. You know, I think a lot of times when you're trying to create a character or a story, you do start out with a certain movie or something like that. And, you know, it's funny, a lot of taglines, that's what they'll do. You know, they'll say like, you know, something along the lines of like, you know, it's RoboCop meets Terminator or something like that. You know what I mean? They'll use that as a pitch, you know, as a log line to get some interest in the project, you know? So that's a very, 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 very common thing. And a lot of times when you hear it, it's the end result is nothing like that. It's not what they pitched at all. And there's various reasons that happens. But it's kind of cool to see when you can do something like that and you can do it right and you can kind of be inspired by somebody else's work and do something really cool, you know, and do something that becomes your own. And in this case also takes place in the DC universe, which is also really cool. So,
yeah, I remember when we first came on board, I love the idea and the concept of this series. And it was just so weird because I'm kind of removed from it now, because I haven't really looked at these pages in quite some time. And having just seen They Live and actually revisiting some of the pages from the series, I was like, yeah, we did really kind of capture, you know, that kind of idea. And I didn't realize how, you know, within a DC universe context anyway, that we had kind of gotten that close to the idea. Because these two have a crazy fight that goes on for quite some time. And I kept thinking, it's like, wow, definitely this first issue four, definitely very much is very much in the vein of They Live. So I just found that kind of interesting.
That's very, very
all right. So, all right. So I just wanted to share that because I promised in the last episode that I would discuss my work on the DC Comics series They Live and actually talk about how They Live not only influenced Grifter, but in some ways was very much intended to be the inspiration, at least as far as I understood it, for the Grifter series.
That's very, very cool. And it's also cool because there, as far as I know, there's nothing else that was really done with They Live. So basically you can look at the original short story, the comic book adaptation of that short story, the movie, and that's it. So this might also be something, if someone is really into this and likes the premise, it's like, well, here's something that's kind of similar that you could check out that you might enjoy.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And then also too, we highlighted it last episode for those people, you know, we do a Collector's Corner episode. For those of you who might be watching right now, they're new to the show. The Collector's Corner episode that we do on Thursday night, we had actually highlighted the Funko Pop They Live little collectible figurine, little characters they've got coming out. And that's kind of cool too. So it's interesting because it's definitely a cult classic and They Live is continuing to live, pardon the pun, past, I think, maybe when most people would have thought that people had forgotten about the movie, but it's still being discussed. It's still being talked about. And it's still oddly relevant for the time. Even though the period of time in which it was made, which it was intended to be a commentary for, those days have long gone. So it's interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So again, so those of you watching, if you're in the Rogues Gallery, please tell us how you feel about the film They Live. If you've watched it recently or if you remember how you felt about it back in the day, feel free to chime in and tell us what you thought about the film. We definitely want to know your thoughts. So at this point, Eric, if that's good, I think we'll go ahead and go to pop culture.
Yeah, that sounds good to me.
All right, very cool. So here in the pop culture news segment, we'll talk about anything that's happening with the pop culture news. Usually it's something that's caught Eric's attention or my attention. At the very least, we hope it's something that you will find worthy of discussion. that's what we like to talk about in the pop culture news. All right, so for the show today, I have only one story, and we'll see if I can get my graphic to load up correctly, and it's still acting up. gotta love that. All right. So this is my pop culture news story. We're not going to go to a website today and read someone's blurb. We're not going to reflect on what other people think. We're going to talk about what we think. And we want to react just genuinely to what is being presented to us at the moment. All right. Now, what we have here, and there's a specific reason why I put these images together. What we have here on the right-hand side of your screen is Zachary Levi, who plays Shazam, which a lot of us who grew up with the character know him as Captain Marvel, the original Captain Marvel, the big red cheese, if you were Dr. Savannah and you hate him. And then on the left-hand side, we have Tom Tyler. Tom Tyler was the original Captain Marvel from the movie serials for the 1940s, The Adventures of Captain Marvel, considered by many to still be a classic. Still can be considered to be a classic. Now, the reason I put these images side by side is because when I watched the original Shazam movie, I didn't have any issues with the suit at the time. Okay. And we're going to be talking about the costume. I didn't have any issues with the suit at the time. I thought it was fine. I liked it. Okay. I guess in hindsight, it did kind of bug me a little bit more than I realized, which is interesting. There's just something about it that never really sat right with me. And I feel like it's because in hindsight, with the images of the new suit that have come out, it really highlighted to me how very much they were trying to make Shazam, because that's what they're calling him now. They wanted to make Shazam very much be like Superman, right? At least that's what I thought. There's so much talk about Superman, so many references to Superman. It seemed like with the suit, they wanted him to basically be essentially Superman, that's what they were going for. Which is interesting, because the whole reason that DC Comics it's not that they did own, it's the reason they don't own the rights to the name Captain Marvel is because of the lawsuit that happened back in the 40s between Fawcett Publications, at that time National Periodicals, were basically National Periodicals, publisher of Superman, sued Fawcett Publications for saying that they were ripping off their character, and they actually won the lawsuit, and Fawcett Publications had to cease publishing at that time the Captain Marvel comic books. At that time, Captain Marvel was as popular, and in some cases more popular than Superman, and because of that, Superman is still in the spoken and then kind of the pop culture and sort of the public consciousness at large. And Captain Marvel, to an extent, at one point had almost been but forgotten. And when they rolled him out much later, they had to call him Shazam because Marvel had managed to actually sneak the rights to the term Captain Marvel, so that now Marvel Comics actually owns that name. So what's interesting about this new suit, the thing I like about this new suit the most, and it hit me immediately when I saw it, with the size of the lightning bolt, the cut of the suit, the way that it fits his body, and the cape is going to be added in post-production, is my understanding. So he is still going to have the cape, but it's just they're going to put it in with CGI, like what they did with Superman, with the Henry Cavill Superman, which is fine. The thing I like about this new suit, despite all the textures and the accents and all the extra little things that they've tried to put into it, I like this suit because when you think about the Tom Tyler version of Captain Marvel, I feel like this suit is more reminiscent of that. I mean, do you think I'm crazy, Eric?
No, I can see it. I like the classic suit. I probably like it more than what they've done in either of the Shazam movies. But I like them all. I mean, I don't know. I didn't have a problem with the suit in the original film. I don't have a problem with the one in the serial, and I don't have a problem with the one now. I like them all. I think they're cool. I'm just glad to see the character. I wish they could use the Captain Marvel name because I feel like he deserves it. But it is what it is.
Yeah, that's true. That's something that really can't be undone at this point. But I've seen a lot of people reacting and talking about it, and I thought it would be fun to chime in I know that you're a Captain Marvel fan, Eric, and I've been a big Captain Marvel Shazam fan for as long as I can remember. Actually, for this coming Thursday's episode, The Collector's Corner, I'm going to actually try and do a full Captain Marvel episode on my side with the trading cards and the comics. Those are the recommendations. They're all going to be Captain Marvel themed. I think that would be really fun to do. And of course, I mean the original, the DC Comics Captain Marvel, not the Marvel Captain Marvel. I really like this new suit. I feel like that it's just more reminiscent of the original from the movie serials. And there's just something about that image. And I feel like it's kind of, in my mind, more a classic approach to Captain Marvel than the one that we got before. I felt like the other one was more a Man of Steel Superman kind of look. And this, to me, feels more like an old school Captain Marvel look. So I like the way this is looking, even though it's got all the crazy little accents and all the extra little doodads and whatever. I just really feel like I like this one a lot better. So, all right. Well, there you go. Those of you in the Rogues Gallery, if you have a comment, please tell us, what do you think? I mean, can you see what I see? Can you see that the new suit kind of more reminiscent of the old movie serial version of Captain Marvel, or do you think I've completely lost my mind? I just feel like this suit is kind of more fitting for the character, at least in my mind. And I don't mean form fitting. I mean, just stylistically, I feel like it looks better on the character. So, all right. So that's what I had for pop culture. Do you have anything for pop culture this week, Eric?
No, I didn't have anything at all. I actually was saw somebody else talking about this, and so I did actually consider talking about it. I was like, oh, somebody else was talking about it. So I'm glad that Dave decided to talk about it so independently, because we generally come up with our pop culture stories on our own independently. So it's kind of neat that worked out.
Yeah, like I said, the reason I want to talk about it is because I actually like it. I think it's kind of, like I said, to me, it just feels more appropriate for the character. Like I could have actually gone and taken an old Filmation image, not the live action where they're traveling in the Winnebago with Mentor and all that, but actually just the cartoon version, and put the cartoon version next to this suit, and it feels more right and more in line. Because there's just something about that other suit. I feel like it's trying too hard to be like Man of Steel Superman, and there's just something about it that doesn't sit right with me. But I really like the cut of this suit. Although it's ironic because without the cape, my initial thought, I did immediately think of Black Adam. So I was like, oh, they're retooling the suit. So, you know, Black Adam's suit will fit, right? Like it'll be more in line, you know. Won't seem as out of left field, which is funny because I really like the version of the Black Adam suit that's a more contemporary upgrade where he actually has a cape as well. I like the look of the Black Adam suit with the actual cape. So I guess that'll be next. I wonder if that's what we'll see, what'll be coming out here pretty soon. We'll start seeing images actually from The Rock's Black Adam movie. That should be fun. So I think these will be fun.
I'll be interested to see that for sure, to see what that's
going
to
look like. Very cool. All right. So do you have anything for Streaming Wars? Unfortunately, I do not.
No. I haven't seen any interesting news at all. So it's a slow news day as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, most of what I've seen is kind of more, you know, rumor mill and people could, you know, kind of just commenting on things and whatever, which is fine.
I've seen YouTubers turning on each other because it's a slow news day. I've seen that, yeah. Creating drama and stuff like that, because that's what sells, folks. That's what sells. Probably need some more drama on this show.
I don't know. I don't know.
It's frustrating. We were talking about it backstage, and I'm not going to name names about it, but it's just frustrating when you see, and you also see the way that these people treat each other. And it's like, you know, they espouse that they're somehow different than the other side. No, they're not. They're not. They're all drama queens. It's just the bottom line. That's what sells. You know, that's what gets you the clicks and the views. So,
yeah, I guess so. I guess so. Well, I guess with that, that might be it for this episode of the Retro Rogues Live. Unless anyone in the Rogues Gallery has anything else that they would like to talk about, I think we'll probably just call it an episode. All right. All right, so I want to thank you for hopefully watching or listening to this episode of the Retro Rogues Live. Greatly appreciate you taking some time here on this Sunday afternoon and watching the show and discussing, in my mind anyway, the cult classic John Carpenter movie, They Live. Again, if you're interested to check the film out, again, you can watch it on the Peacock. It doesn't cost you anything other than to give them your email address. But if you want to check it out, it's right there for you to watch. And I think we both fell on the side of giving it a recommendation. All right. So with that, if you're interested to learn more about me, and I will have a big announcement, hopefully next episode. We just haven't had enough time to really properly plan it out, but hopefully next episode I'll have a big announcement for what's going on with me, which will be really fun. But anyhow, you can go and check out my t-shirt company, Kirby Tees. That's K-I-R-B-Y-T-S, KirbyTees.com. We've got a lot of fun t-shirts over there. You want to check them out. We've got Sarah Aerosmith, Brains Are Magic. We also have the Janimal collaboration with myself, the Skeletor, as well as some Retro Rogues t-shirts as well. So definitely go there, check it out, and maybe consider purchasing a Retro Rogues Live t-shirt and supporting what we're doing here on the show. We greatly appreciate your support. And in addition to that, if you know anyone who you think would like the show, friend, family, foe, doesn't matter, tell them about the Retro Rogues Live. Please share those links, tell people about it, and let's see if we can get some more people commenting and hopefully participating in the show. And I want to thank Eric Alexander, my great co-host, for coming on and, as always, providing his unique perspective and opinion that is sometimes different than mine, but I always love hearing what he's got to say. Eric, please tell the folks who'll be watching or listening at home where they can learn more about you on the interwebs.
Well, I'm most active on Twitter. You can reach me there at BassGod14. That's at BassGod14. That's also the official Twitch. That's also the official YouTube. By the way, the YouTube is actually very close to 200 subscribers. So if any of you folks who are, you know, that you generally watch us on a different platform, say Facebook, I think we have a pretty decent audience on Facebook, consider subscribing to the YouTube anyway, just so we can get that subscriber number up, because that just makes us look better. So I do encourage people to do that, because we are very close to the 200 subscriber mark on YouTube. And consider the fact that long-term YouTube is probably the most clear path to any kind of monetization for us, which will only help us to improve the show if we can put some money into it. So we would appreciate that. So again, as Dave said, please like, you know, share, subscribe, as they say. And if you don't like it, come on, call us out. Come on, we could use some drama and some hate on this channel. We'll take it. You know what I mean? We get little comments and little snipes every once in a while, but then nobody shows up to call us out live. So come on, let's see what you got, right? But yeah, again, if my DMs are open on Twitter, so if you have any suggestions or anything like that, please let me know. If you're hearing anything in the rumor mill, you have a story that, you know, something that's coming up that you think is worth talking about. The news cycle is a little bit weird now, it feels like, with this new format, because sometimes we're like saturated with news, and then there's other times where it feels like there's like nothing going on. So definitely, if you're hearing something you want us to comment on, us please let us know, because we definitely can use it for the show, and we'll try to do some research on it, you know, and all that good stuff, because, you know, a lot of you folks out there, I know you're busy, and we can facilitate that a little bit, where we can actually go out there and try to find some more information about whatever it is that you're interested in. So I do want to go ahead and go back to the Rogues Gallery. Jane has a really cool little quote here. She says, like Lois Lane said, it's not a great story. You make the story great. And with that, we will leave Jane with the last word.
We want to thank you for listening to this episode of the Retro Rogues Live podcast. You can learn more about Eric Alexander and Find the Live Show on either Twitch, YouTube, or Twitter by searching for BassGod14, that's BassGod14, on either YouTube, Twitch, or Twitter. If you are curious about co-host Dave Beatty, you can see some of his art Find social media links and so much more at his website, DaveBeatty.com. That's DaveBeatty.com. If you enjoyed this episode of the Retro Rogues Live, be sure to like, share, and subscribe.